From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's always a pleasure to have Blink from Blink on Crime on the program. And we've got lots to talk about tonight. How are you, ma'am?
I'm well, Dana. How are you?
I'm doing good. Now, as in live radio, sometimes we have to change our strategy a little bit. So we're going to only preview part two of what we were going to talk about tonight, but there's a lot to talk about when it comes to part one. And people who don't know, blinkoncrime.com is our sister blog, and we've been covering, and Blink, of course, has been covering, her and her team, the Kyron Horman investigation. And tell us a little bit about what's been going on with that. You had a special interview done.
I did. I was fortunate enough to interview Dee Dee Spicer, who, by most accounts, if not all accounts, was considered to be somewhat of the linchpin of the suspicion, if you will, against Terry Horman, the stepmother of Kyron Horman, who, you know, irrefutably is the target, as you read also, is the target of law enforcement suspicion having to do with the circumstances of Kyron Horman's disappearance. He was seven. Actually, yesterday would have been, or it was, his 11th birthday.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was the first time that Ms. Spicer has spoken, and according to her and her attorney, maybe the last. but they will not be speaking to local media, and he will, Chad Stavely will be issuing a press release at the end of the week,
now,
is my understanding.
Well, let's get into this a little bit. Normally, when you do a story, or Red does a story, or I do something on the show here, we're not considered to be mainstream media. We're, you know, the blogosphere. I hate that term, if you want to call it that. But it's really interesting to see how much of the mainstream media jumps on these stories when you write them, and the mainstream media have been all over this one, haven't they?
They have. I've had that quite a few times, in drips and drabs, but this certainly was, in this case especially, you know, I guess considered a, and this is related to me from the local media, a coup in that, you know, I'm here in Princeton, New Jersey, and, you know, it's a good thing, you know, and I think they handled it well, personally, because I've had other experiences where, in other cases, and I want to say in this case, very early on, where we were talking about the landscaper.
Right.
Things like that, that I didn't feel like were handled that well, but I really feel like Ms. Spicer coming forward and, you know, being interviewed and being very open was well received by a public that, there is no doubt about it, was not feeling good about Ms. Spicer.
Well,
and unfairly.
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. And why the interview and why now?
I believe, and I'm going to speak for Ms. Spicer's just because of what she's told me a little bit, why now is an easy answer. And, well, it's an easy for me to say answer. It wasn't easy for her to deal with. She agreed to a polygraph examination in an immunity agreement, which was put together so that she would testify in front of the grand jury. It was not an easy time for Ms. Spicer. In her words, she was threatened with all kinds of things, but one was prosecution for working, you know, which was supposed to be an unpaid position as an intern on a local farm prior to a organization's, like a conservancy day or what have you, and at the time wasn't aware that that was something she needed a 1099 for, and we're talking a very minimal amount of money that she would have been happy to say, oh, okay, you know. As a matter of fact, it was less than what she paid her counsel to represent her. So for her, she's clear that she was mistreated, that she was maligned. She was literally bullied into taking a polygraph. And when I say she was bullied into it, I say that because that's how she feels, but also because there was nothing whatsoever that she said from the last 3-plus years that changed within that polygraph that did not be proven true.
Now, we're going to tie in Ms. Spicer to Terry Horman here in a few minutes, but I want you to go back just a little bit as far as the quote-unquote threats against her, some kind of an old case she was working and she shouldn't have been. That's old-style investigations. Let's find a witness or a potential witness, see if we can dig up some dirt on them, and let's hold this over their head and see if, until they talk about something else. What about that? That kind of crap went out in the 50s, didn't they?
It did, and it was more than that. And as I outlined in the piece, unfortunately, an exchange occurred with Norm Frank, who was the associate deputy attorney at the time. She had more than a few. We're going to talk in the continuation when that publishes, either hopefully late tonight, about another exchange that she had. But in this particular one, Mr. Frank was telling her, well, I'll tell you what he said. I'm paraphrasing from the piece, which is quoted. And he said, we don't really think you had anything to do with this, but we believe that you have information that Terry Horman did, and you know what that is. And so you're either going to agree to our polygraph, and her lawyer had advised her not to for obvious reasons, or I don't care. We're going to tell the family, meaning Desiree Young and Kane Horman, that you did have something to do with it.
Jeez.
And she said, well, I'm sorry that, you know, you feel that way, but I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to, you know, jeopardize myself. I don't have anything to tell you. I don't have any information. And, you know, my attorneys. And by the way, Dana, this threat, and in my mind, she termed it as a blackmail and was not shy about how I was reporting and quoting her on it. She absolutely feels that that was an attempt, at least one, of blackmailing her. And her response was, you know, you're going to have to do, I guess, what you're going to have to do. But in her heart of hearts, she would tell you she felt at the time, you can't threaten people to say things to other people that aren't true.
Right.
And boy, was she wrong.
And the story will continue. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Let's tie in Dee Dee Spicer and Terry Horman. How close were they? How did they know each other?
They met several years ago at a gym in Beaverton, Oregon. And while they're longtime friends, you know, from the time span, they were not particularly close. We reference in the piece, they had spoken briefly, I think December 2009. They actually saw each other again in March of 2010, but that was as a result of Kane reaching out by email to all of Terry's friends saying, hey, I'm going to be planning this 40th birthday party. You know, I could use any help and suggestions. And and to Dee Dee's chagrin, she, of course, responded, sure, I'd be willing to help or whatever. And she said, which was the same as, here, you do all of it,
Yeah. Because
I have to work. That was her descriptive to me. Not so crazily uncommon, I guess, for husbands. But she was willing to and work with a few gals. But that was the last time that that Dee Dee Spicer had been in contact of any kind with Terry Horman until after Kyron disappeared on June 4th, 2010.
When law enforcement come knock on your door and want to ask you questions, I would say 99% of the people out there want to cooperate, want to help. They're trustworthy. And this gal was trusting the cops. But there's a little bit of background for Dee Dee Spicer. Her dad was a sheriff, wasn't he?
Yes, in Klamath Falls. Very well-respected gentleman, very well long-term law enforcement, but also in charge of, at one time, headed up the search and rescue efforts in Klamath Falls as well. One thing I did not put in the piece, So and I'm not putting the piece tomorrow. So here's an exclusive. One thing I did learn was that her dad, who was not associated any longer at the time of Kyron's disappearance with Klamath Falls Search and Rescue, they had been called in to what I refer to as Ground Zero, which is the Skyline School, late evening, next day of Kyron's disappearance, because, you know, they were doing what you do. You're doing search and rescue around the school. They believe that Kyron had wandered off. And what she told me was that she was told that the search and rescue team got there from Klamath Falls, and the site was completely uncontained. There were civilians running in and out of the school. There were other agencies, other what I call SAR, search and rescue teams, walking in and out without any type of protocols or, you know, evidence preservation or CSI, none of that. And the captain looked at his team and said, I don't want anything to do with this. This is a contaminated scene, and you know how that goes. Right. I don't want that on us. And they turned around and they left.
Well, Blink from Blink No Crime is here. We're talking about her story on Kyron Horman and her exclusive interview with Dee Dee Spicer, part two coming soon, maybe even tonight. You mentioned early on in the in our interview that that Dee Dee, this may be the last time she speaks publicly. Her and her lawyer a little joked with her that she spoke to you?
I don't speak for him, obviously.
Yeah.
But I would characterize it as, first of all, she alerted her attorney that she would be speaking with me.
Sure, yeah.
On one other occasion, the only other interview she has given, which is certainly nothing like ours, it was kind of preliminary, was with Elaine from, who's, I apologize, her last name escapes me, although I know her, the editor from People Magazine. And what his concern was that, you know, she certainly has the right to do that, but wanted to get an alert because he was deluged
mm-hmm.
with the press. So we that didn't happen. She made sure that he was aware of it. And I have to say that she has, when I say enjoyed, she's been happy with her representation. These are my words, based on hers, with Mr. Stavely, is respectful of him and his advice. And I think that she is so focused on her goal, Dana, was to come out and say, look, there's no mystery. Here's what's gone on. The mystery end of things is how I have been treated to end up where we are. And if I don't talk, if I don't say what's gone on, this investigation is not going to switch gears. And something's wrong if 3.5 years later, I'm supposed to be the linchpin to a case against Terry Horman, and they find out I have no information. I wasn't involved.
Yeah.
You know, 2 and 2 does not equal, you know, what's, you know, 365 times 3. It doesn't. How many days are we talking about?
Yeah.
And, you know, as your law enforcement, it pains me. I was to the point where I had to take a break from our interview because it's almost like you want to stop and verify in the middle because it sounds so fantastic. And you can't, but you have to get through it, and then you do your verifications and your fact checks and your corroboration. And she's as legit, for me, she was as legit as one could be. And I was probably more surprised than anybody about that, having what she's been through.
When you talked about the polygraph, and her attorney recommends that she not take the polygraph. And if you go on in your story, your report here, you'll see that eventually she does. And,
yeah.
And then even then, she's still blamed for wasting time, for lack of a better term. So this poor gal can't win for losing. But what about that? Has she ever thought about, well, you know, maybe if I'd taken that polygraph right from the get-go, none of this would have happened?
I think she has thought about it. I think she's incensed by that notion, because that's not what our Constitution says. Polygraphs aren't legally admissible, but more than that, and you know, this is what comes from having sound attorney advice, sound criminal attorney advice. There, had she done that, there is no obligation on the behalf of law enforcement to be honest with her.
Right. Yep.
As to whether or not she passed. They could have looked right at her and say, oh, we knew it, you're lying, you failed. And that was not okay with her. So her opinion was that she was, even though she was being advised against it, her questions were, you know, can we talk about the fact that if I take it, I want to know unequivocally if I passed it or not. Not that, you know, you use it because, you know, here when she was staying in the Horman home with Terry, and I should actually say before that, she wasn't staying in it, but she was there. She had visited. Kane and Terry were still in the home together. Law enforcement was in and out. She recounted a conversation that she had, I believe she said, sitting on the floor in Kyron's bedroom. And I'm paraphrasing here, but Terry had said, you know, I took this polygraph. They're telling me that I flunked, and I have to take it again. And I'm telling the truth. You know, I don't know what to say about that or do about that. And she said that Terry had said to her, you know, I said to them, well, if I get a lawyer, does that mean that you have to tell me if I pass it or if you're just telling me that I passed it? And they said, well, I guess if you get a lawyer, you can get a lawyer. But no, we don't have to tell you that. And also, we're not going to tell you anything about what's going on in terms of the efforts to find Kyron. Now, you can read that one of two ways. You know, if you're a suspect, maybe that's important. If you're a doting, at the time, stepmom, and there's really just no verifiable accounts that she wasn't, you know, that's traumatic. Plus, you have your husband who's questioning you, who was telling police at the time she flunked. I don't even know to this day if it's true, and neither did Dee Dee. So Dee Dee's advice to her was, you can do what you want personally. I would never talk to them again without an attorney. I just wouldn't do it. My dad has told me this. You know, our other friends that are being bullied has told me this. So the point I want to make, Dana, is that Terry was one of the last people to have an attorney. She did not hire an attorney, did not consult with an attorney until after Kane Horman filed the restraining order where he unilaterally took custody of their baby daughter,
right,
Kiara. And it was at that time then she saw counsel. But she went back for a second and a third polygraph, and hours and hours and hours of interviews. And police seemed to indicate to Dee Dee that, well, not just police, but Kane Horman and Desiree Young put out a statement that Dee Dee was, you know, giving advice to others about not talking or not cooperating with law enforcement. The translation of that is, I'm not going to be speaking to anybody without counsel. And the reality is, Kane had counsel before anyone.
Right, yeah.
In that situation.
So let's get into this some more. Blink from Blink on Crime is here for the entire show tonight, and we're going to deal with this Dee Dee Spicer interview and how it affects the Kyron Horman investigation. And you can learn more by going to blinkoncrime.com. So we've talked about the district attorney, now the investigators. And Dee Dee is, you know, she's getting advice from an attorney, your dad, all that sort of stuff. But she eventually does sit down and talk with the police, correct?
Well, I'd like to point out, she sat down with the police several dozens of times. All she requested was that she did so with her attorney. She never refused a meeting. In fact, there was, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, she initiated a meeting herself where she brought in, as I said, I'm going to preview this, but other areas of law enforcement that was familiar with her and her family to meet with the district attorney on her own, and those folks came in on their own dime. As kind of a character, you know, like, this is who she is, we've known her our entire life,
right,
you know, that kind of thing. You don't see that a lot in law enforcement, getting in the middle.
No, you want to leave things alone. But so what was the law enforcement's focus on her then? Their friends heard Terry from the past at a gym, but there's got to be more to it. why are they focusing so much on her?
She said that she believes she came into focus initially because she bought, I call them burner phones. They're prepaid phones, you know, that you can buy at Walmart or any other store, where you purchase them. They have a number of minutes loaded. You know, they're not trackable to the owner. I'm sure you're familiar with that, right?
Yep, you bet.
Okay. But the thing for me, that purchase was necessitated by Terry Horman's, after Kane served that restraining order, she sought the legal advice of a family friend who ended up referring her to her current attorney, Stephen House. But in that meeting, whereby she informed Dee Dee was not at that meeting, but that she was told law enforcement has bugged your house, is monitoring all your calls, is monitoring your friend's calls, you know, et cetera, et cetera. My advice to you, if you want to have a private conversation, is to get, this kind of phone, if that's of a concern. And so that's where that came from. And that was well after Kyron's disappearance. That was what she felt, because what happened was, is when they finally came to her, and by the way, they never requested an interview with Dee Dee Spicer until they served a warrant on her house.
A warrant looking for what?
That warrant was restricted to electronic devices. And so in my mind, I have not seen the warrant. It is not public domain.
Right.
But if it's strictly electronic devices, I believe she's correct.
Yeah.
That based on the fact that she was staying in the Horman home, which was under surveillance, she was in direct contact with their person of interest, Terry Horman, that somehow they were able to get that device. And they took it, they seized it, they searched it, they gave it back to her in about 2 weeks, all of it.
And that device was a phone?
There was two phones and a laptop. There was her regular phone, which she had for years and years and years, they took that, the prepaid phone, which was new, and her laptop, all of which she got back in about 3 weeks.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Blink from Blink on Crime, and we're going to continue on with the information on the Dee Dee Spicer interview and how it connects to the Kyron Harmer investigation. You are listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Blink from Blink on Crime is here talking about her exclusive interview with Terry Horman's friend Dee Dee Spicer. Dee Dee has broken her silence after passing a polygraph to test and requests that the DA clear her publicly. And what do you think the chances of that happening are, Blink?
I don't know.
Well, I was hoping you'd have more of an answer than that, but you know, this is pissing off the DA.
He's not, Norm Frank is not in office.
Yeah.
Any longer.
But even the current guy, because DA's.
I would think it would be most unsettling because.
Unsettling. Okay, I'll take that other comment I made back.
Well, you know, only because I can't verify that whether or not he's pissed off, but I would certainly believe that he was.
We'll say allegedly pissed off.
Putting myself in his, you know, virtual shoes, I would be screaming.
Oh.
I've seen Rod Underhill do exactly one press conference, which was the day after, I believe, the first grand jury was either suspended or dismissed, and it was a request for public information, and he certainly seemed like a decent guy. What was odd to me was the second time I saw him was when he was standing on the front of the Multnomah County steps or the courthouse when Desiree Young was announcing her $10 million lawsuit against Terry Horman, which he originally, when Judge Cantor asked him whether the county had a position, which was weird anyway because it's a civil suit. They don't really have, you know, standing. They're not a party to it. And then what happened was in the middle of that case, he then filed, his office then filed, a request to abate it based on the fact that it, you know, potentially could infringe on investigative confidential information. So I found that odd, knowing that I watched him stand there on the front steps.
now we're going to bounce around a little bit here, but even as recent as the 10th of July, Dee Dee was subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury. Let's talk about her grand jury experience.
She was there, I want to say, 5 hours. And in her estimation, she was asked, and you're familiar with the setting that she, you know, the jurors can ask basically anything they want.
Sure.
There's a lead-in from the prosecutor, et cetera, and things that she gets asked. The few highlights that she shared with me, I certainly was left with the impression that it wasn't the fact-finding initiative that she was led to believe that it was, or that she just was under the impression that it was, because she hadn't been questioned previously. Things like a few areas where, I mean, she understood why they asked the questions because the detectives had asked it from her, so she realized they were prompted in some way. But one of the questions was, well, if you weren't very close with Terry Horman, then, you know, why would you, you know, run over there when you got a text message that said, I need you now? I mean, there's the person went on to say, you know, I've had friends that I've been friends with for 15 years that I may not have spoken with, say, in the last 2 or 3 months or whatever. And I'm pretty sure if I hadn't, if they just texted me, I wouldn't get in my car and go over there.
Right.
Yeah. And her response was, well, I can appreciate what you're saying, and I certainly hope that you never need a friend like that that quickly.
Well, exactly. So,
another area was they were, you know, hyper concerned about her sexuality. Things like, you know, were you in a lesbian relationship with Terry Horman? If I had to, you know, quantify it, so to speak, I believe they were looking for the motive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would be the reason why she would support? You know, why is she holding out? And of course, pointing out that at the time of the grand jury, she did have immunity. She did have transactional immunity, but she had not taken the polygraph. So the grand jury didn't have to be made aware of that.
Explain the immunity part.
There's a difference between what's called use immunity and not an attorney. This is not legal advice.
Right.
How many times do you think I've been told to say that in the last week? So there's a difference between transactional immunity and limited use immunity. For the most part, when a person is called upon the grand jury, provided that they testify and don't invoke their Fifth Amendment right, because the Constitution provides that we do not self-incriminate, they are given what's called limited use immunity.
Right.
And that means that whatever you're asked, that information cannot be held against you in a criminal proceeding. In other words, they can't build a case against you based on what you tell them when they ask. It can happen that, you know, they might limit the scope of their questioning when they know they have other evidence. So it's not to say that they're going to call somebody for the grand jury for the sole purpose of giving them immunity. It is feasible that they could call somebody that they have some criminal suspicions about, but the prosecutor could elect not to ask them about them so they could build a case outside of what is said. Is that clear?
Sure. Yep.
Okay. So with transactional immunity, what's different about that is absolutely unequivocally nothing that is said, tangentially or not, or that's testified to in that scope, is ever prosecutable, period. So it's sometimes referred as blanket immunity. Now, either one of those is negated or nullified potentially by the ability to prove somebody has perjured themselves. And it would not carry through to any acts after the fact. It would be difficult since she's been interrogated for 3 years straight, and that would be the basis of the questions before the grand jury, you know, to kind of, you know, skirt the issue if somebody wanted to go after her after the fact. There's really not a lot of tolerance for that, which is why as we get further into the piece where they had asked her to participate in the sting, there was great pause about that.
Yeah, let's get right to that, the sting. What was that all about? The cops and the DA are trying real hard to get this young gal to help them, and now they're wanting her to, you know, to set up Terry Horman, so to speak, or try and get some information. What happened there?
You know, I'll answer it this way. With my one is my opinion, and which, you know, everyone has one. My opinion is that I would be very concerned about why, after 3+ years, they hound this woman, tell her she's lying, they don't believe her, you know, yada, yada, yada. She testifies, gets immunity, testifies in front of the grand jury. She passes a polygraph after the fact. And their first order of business is to order her attorney. I'm sorry, that's poor wording. Ask her if she can meet with them outside of the presence of her attorney. And then ask her to participate in a sting, which would not be covered under her immunity agreement. Now, they didn't say those words to her. I'm just giving you fact basis as to my concern. And then told her, and you can't discuss this with your attorney. I thought, you know, you are literally kidding me.
Right.
It sounded fantastic. Some of it, it was difficult for me during the interview to not be emotional, to not stutter, to not take a breath, to not interject. I'm kind of an animated gal, if you noticed.
Yeah, I would just slightly, yes, yeah.
I was just like, you know, I didn't offer any opinion. And I worked pretty hard at doing that because it was hard. I mean, she literally has been put through some techniques. You know, and in criminal investigation, there is some of that. And sometimes I think it can be necessary. But as I look at this, you know, in the weeds, having been at 30,000 feet, as I like to say before, there was not a single stitch of evidence to support the theories that they were working under to suspect her in the first place. There was no communication. There was no communication on June 4th. She was where she said she was. She had a witness. They would not verify whether or not they spoke to that witness. They would not tell her whether the things that she was saying, you know, were corroborated in any other way because they wanted her to feel like she was being, you know, they didn't believe her. There just was no corroborating evidence to hold a suspicion of this woman. Saying, you know, she's too good of a friend for the type of friend that someone else was to her is not a criminal suspicion, you know, motivator, in my opinion.
Well, it's an investigative technique, I guess, to focus on a contact, on a friend, and see if you can get them to roll over, for lack of a better term. But they've taken this so far. How old of a girl is Aditi?
She's 2 years younger than me, but don't quote me on that. I'm 44. I believe she's 42. Don't quote me on that. I could be in trouble.
Okay. No. And not that that's important, but yeah, you got to wonder, for someone who has never gone through anything like this, all of a sudden to have the bright lights in your eyes, the smoky room, the interrogation, the old style, because I'm calling this is me 50s style police work. And you're going to continue on, and we'll get you to maybe throw out a couple of previews as far as what part two is going to be all about. How did this young gal not just tell them all just to jump in the lake? And I almost said a bad word here. And
I'll say it for you.
and go there, because
I literally, you know, as I said, I tried to remain as objective and as neutral as I could, because I want to hear the raw and pure information, you know, from the witness, from the interview. And so as we got further into it and we get into the fact-checking and, you know, verifications and quote approvals, I was able to be a little more open. And I literally said to her, I have to tell you something. I think you're courageous, because I don't know that I wouldn't have told them to F off.
That's right.
I really, you know, when you're a person that works at having integrity, and you know that, I mean, here's the thing about the truth. If somebody's telling you you're not being truthful, but you know it's true, categorically, then one of you is lying and it's not you.
Yeah, exactly.
So if, you know, for her ability to continue to subject herself and be clear, she did. interview upon interview upon interview, she was willing to sit there, be told she wasn't truthful, be told she wasn't this. And, you know, this lady has a full life of, you know, I'll give you an example. One time when I was, we had an appointment to conduct part of the interview, and she had to excuse herself because she was chasing feral cats that she had found, and out of her own pocket was going to take them to be spayed or neutered or whatever. I don't own cats, so I wasn't, and I was like, why are you doing that? She's like, well, you know, what happens is they just, this happens, and then they go have kittens, then they're out on my doorstep, and then I've got, you know, 20 cats, and I thought, oh my God, you know, that's a really nice person.
Yep.
To go ahead and do that, not drop them off. And another time we were in an interview, she had to excuse herself from a senior citizens knitting group that she had started.
Good for her.
And I was, again, do you see where I'm going with where?
Sure, yep.
I really was like, this is fantastic that this is going on, because she is legit. I have held collateral corroborative interviews with folks that were under a confidentiality agreement, so they can't even tell her that I spoke to them. I have never had that, you know, they're adamant. She's just legit. She is, this is one of those folks that would come to the aid of someone who, you know, and she'll tell you that, you know, maybe she doesn't agree 100% with some of the lifestyle issues that Terry had, or even the way Terry kind of thought of herself. You know, at one point she said to me, well, Terry had a lot of drama.
Right.
I don't know why she, you know, thought about herself this way. So it wasn't like she wasn't real to the situation, you know, or that she thought Terry was not imperfect like everyone. It wasn't anything like that. She just, you know, she's a legitimately nice gal who believes, in my opinion, that getting past her would be able to shine the light on Kyron. And when, you know, I asked her after the fact, Dana, I said, well, how did you feel? Like, after you passed the polygraph test, I mean, for me, I'd have been like, I'm trying to think of the right scene in the movie, you know, where it's like, suck it.
Yeah.
Tina Fey,
yeah.
You know, I told you. How do you like that?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But I can be immature about such things. And she said, well, when Mark Herron, Detective Mark Herron, you know, I come back in the room and he's like, I am so excited about this. You're part of the team. You know, like the whole high five attitude, you know, welcome. Great. You're on board. And she was like, I thought it was like a bad dream. And then to be asked to participate in this thing was the ultimate. That stressed her out.
Oh, I imagine.
That stressed her out. Like, what? And I don't think she even had the capacity at the time. And you know what? I'll say it differently. To this day, because I haven't shared my opinion with her that I was suspect that law enforcement might be trying to entrap her in an area that she wasn't immune to. Because I don't believe they thought she would pass the polygraph. I truly do not. Or that was a conversation they were not wanting to have with their boss after 3.5 years where they said, oh, just let's have some more time. It's her. It's her.
Yeah.
She's the key. She's the key.
Yeah.
I can see that in my mind's eye like nothing else.
I would be asking the question. They blamed her for wasting time. I'd be asking those detectives a question, why have you been wasting time on this woman?
Absolutely. Somebody better. Because 3.5 years later, there is a 7-year-old child that went missing from a school who has never been named in a lawsuit. And I should also offer that the key witnesses in that case, some of them had, and I'm talking about staff, I guess I should think, some of them had lawyers before anybody.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was very fair. They were never named in a lawsuit. They weren't named in Desiree Young's lawsuit. You know, they had, you know, school records that were shredded, you know, were never requested by Multnomah County. That the crime, it was never established as a crime scene. And the piece that I put out before the last one, there was a teacher that literally Kyron was asked to help get something out of the truck. Kyron looks up at her. She nods her head. He walks out, was seen by multiple witnesses, but that happened.
Yeah.
And how does that equate to, you know, it has to be Dee Dee Spicer or it has to be Terry Horman? The configuration and what we put out is a fairly it is in-depth report about some of the issues with law enforcement involved in this case that would call into question why those folks are investigating a missing persons case in the first place.
All right. Blank from Blank on Crime is here. You can go to blankoncrime.com to read this story and part two, which will be showing up tonight, tomorrow. Give us a preview of part two, Blank.
The preview of part two is going to discuss, I'll call it a revelation because I don't like that word bombshell ever again in my life.
Gee, I wonder why. Yeah.
I don't own a spatula necklace, don't think I would get to say that anyway. But there are revelations that we learned from Miss Spicer's interview that she had no idea would be, in my opinion, connectable to bits of information we long suspected had developed, were kind of sitting on for those connectors. But it's significant.
It will turn, I think, the reader's eye, if that's possible. Maybe I'm sounding goofy here, but it'll turn the reader to a different focus, because what you do with your work is you bring out the whole story. And it seems to me like the focus was misfocused in this case. We got about 3 minutes left. Dee Dee Spicer, is she doing okay?
She is. Better than I think I would be. She is. She is very adamant. In a conversation we had today, we're getting deluged by mainstream media, and local reporters are, you know, wanting to speak to her, and she's pretty adamant that's of no interest to her. She feels a little bit maligned, you know, there they were maligning her and, you know, printing things that weren't true and things like that. And, you know, to their defense, a little bit, they can only print what they, you know, when somebody get information they give them. They're not an investigative journalist like myself that's fact-checking both sides of the equation, forming an opinion, that kind of thing. There is a big difference between investigative journalism and reporting. That's just true. Yeah. I could never be a reporter. I'd be fired in, you know, 3 seconds. That's just, I'll be honest about that. But I think that she is not interested in further clearing her name. I think she has said what she wants to say. And at the end of this week, through her attorney, they will be issuing a statement. But she is not interested at this point in speaking to anyone else.
I don't blame her.
She wants the focus to be on, here's what happened to me. Here's why the investigative strategy in finding this child has not worked, and why you should be concerned, and why it needs a better look so that the focus changes and the investigation develops leads and furthers the efforts away from where there is nothing to see, where there is no avenue.
Right.
They're just wrong.
Okay, it's blankoncrime.com. Stay tuned tonight, tomorrow. Part two will be posted, and I'm sure it'll be a, I'm not going to say that word that ends with shell. How about humdinger? There's that shows you how old I am.
I don't even know what that means.
You don't know what a humdinger is.
You know what I know? I know barn burner.
Barn burner. It'll be a barn burner. There you go. All right, kiddo. As always, 10 out of 10. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Be well, Dana.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's Blank from blinkoncrime.com with her breaking news, telling the story the way it should be told. And it is a big story. You know, the mainstream media, they grab a hold of these and they run with them for a little bit and then they forget all about it. Well, Kyron Horman's still out there and answers need to be obtained, that's for sure. So stay tuned to blankoncrime.com and scaredmonkeys.com for part two of this breaking story. That's it. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.